Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for June 10th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, the real impact of microcredit programs, how a little high-quality preschool can go a long way, and studying human cognition in a South African cave site. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Microcredit programs, an increasingly popular kind of anti-poverty measure, are designed to provide small loans to individuals, particularly women, who might not otherwise have ready access to credit. The theory is that access to such small loans will assist the recipients in setting up or expanding small businesses, which in turn can help lift them out of poverty. It's an appealing story, so much so that the founder of one microlending initiative received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. But does microcredit really work? And if so, how? Dean Carlin of Yale University and Jonathan Zinman of Dartmouth College take a look at those questions in a paper published this week in Science. In the paper, a randomized study of the experience of 1,600 individuals working with a particular micro-lender in the Philippines, Carlin and Zinman found that microcredit can indeed have a positive impact on recipients, but in a very different way than the usual story suggests. Author Dean Carlin spoke with me about the study from his office at Yale.
What motivates this work is a big debate within the world of development and specifically within the world of microcredit. Microcredit for many years was touted as a kind of panacea, almost silver bullet against poverty. But then there's also been a lot of people who've been fairly critical of it. And what's striking or frustrating as someone who wants to know what to do, what types of policies to prescribe, is that we lacked really rigorous evidence on what the impacts were. We lacked a careful study with a very credible counterfactual analysis, the type we get from doing a randomized trial. And so that's why we embarked on this particular study. The other reason for doing this study is the search for methodologies that are win-wins, that are the types of methodologies that banks or financial institutions can say, wow, this is great, this helps us do our business better, whereas researchers can look at the design and say, oh, wow, this is great, we can use this type of approach to measure impact.
Well, let's step back a minute. When we talk about microcredit, what do we actually mean? Tell me something about these programs and the size of this market.
So the size is huge, literally hundreds of millions of people participating in microcredit programs. Microcredit is it's actually somewhat contentious just how to define it, but in a very simplistic way, microcredit refers to small loans, typically to women, and typically targeted at micro-entrepreneurs, small, really small businesses, zero-employee businesses, where the money is, in theory, being used to help grow the business. And the canonical story that had been told for years is kind of a picture-perfect story that is told in many ways to entice donors and policymakers, but I think in some sense has missed some of the richness of the impact that one can have because some of the richness is not as sexy, it doesn't sell as well. And some of the richness is simply about being able to, for instance, smooth a shock and something bad that happens in someone's life to help mitigate risk. It's even about the ability to buy cement to improve the floor or walls in one's home. But that doesn't tell the story that has been the classic canonical, this is a loan which is helping a poor, fighting woman to help get her out of poverty by helping her invest in a business, earn more money, and invest in health and education of the children. And that's been the story that the microcredit world has told for years. And it's not to say that that never happens, but it's quite clear that the impacts are much more dispersed and not quite as glorious as the industry has tried to claim.
What you're saying suggests that this is an area that's really dominated by sort of anecdotal evidence, with a particular focus, as you say, on the success stories or this sort of narrative about entrepreneurship. How, you know, in setting up your own study of microcredit, did you control for these factors?
Well, this is exactly why we did a randomized trial. Anecdotes can be motivating, can be inspirational, but as we know as scientists, they're just anecdotes, and it's really not hard to pick anecdotes to tell whatever story you want to support. And so the key here is taking the rigor of science to this type of social setting and setting up a randomized trial where some people are randomly assigned to get their loans approved and others are not. And then we follow both over a year to a year and a half, and we find out what actually happens for those who get loans compared to those who do not. We did this in peri-urban Manila in the Philippines, and it was with a for-profit bank that was doing individual liability loans, not group lending, which is, and there was no kind of social mission attached around it, which is very important because if someone thinks that that social mission is what matters for making microcredit work, they might be right. That's not what we were testing. I think one key lesson from this, though, is that context does matter. We're not going to have one answer. One study in one place is not going to be the answer on microcredit. And we need to see replication done in different types of contexts in order to crack this policy nut and figure out what we really should be proposing to people to do.
Okay, you were looking at this specific example in the Philippines. What did you find there in terms of the impact of microlending on the specific recipients you were looking at?
So we found that there were some positive impacts and some borderline negative impacts, but there was no like sweeping success or sweeping failure. That it was clear that rather than expand businesses, a lot of the individuals were actually cutting back on business activities, consolidating them into one bigger activity rather than several smaller ones.
So that almost suggests the opposite of the prevailing narrative then.
Well, I think of that as a risk mitigation is the way we think of this, because it's not that the businesses got smaller on average, right? It's just that they consolidated. And so that, that tells us that, you know, before they were maybe dabbling around in several activities because they didn't have the ability to do one well. And they were also concerned about the risk that they face if they do one on a larger scale. And so they were doing lots of little things. But the access to credit gave them a little bit more flexibility to manage their resources better. Now, there was no change in income, right? And certainly not for women, which is the focus. We actually saw a bigger impact on the income for men than women, which is the flip of how microcredit is often promoted. We also saw a reduction in purchase of formal insurance. Again, an example that the credit is being used as a risk mitigation tool. Similarly, we saw an increase in access to informal lending, right? Not informal usage, but informal access. And this is, again, an important sign that the credit was having important impacts on the ability to mitigate risk and manage risk.
So the fact that they were getting these loans made it easier to find other sources of funding as well?
Exactly. It made them more creditworthy. It made them of higher stature within their community, so they were able to raise other funds if they needed to, if the times were bad. You know, again, these are good things, but it's not the story that everybody's telling, and that's the main finding. And then I think the other important result of this work is really about what it tells us, what more we need to know. I do not take this one study as the end-all. We've uncovered far more further questions we want to ask than answers we've resolved.
So what are some of those questions?
Some of those questions are, how should we really target? If it's not simply about funding entrepreneurs, what are some of the uses that people really are doing with the money on the short run? In some sense, microcredit impact evaluations are often pushed for longer run impacts, but I think one takeaway I had from this is we need to also look at the really short run. What is the immediate place that people are putting the money into? Is it in the household? Is it to put into health, education, or is it the enterprise? And so we're doing actually some really short run studies right now to really get in on that question of what people do with the money. I think the other main thing that I really take away from this is how important other things are other than just credit. How we really need to think harder about savings and insurance. As a very simple example, if someone is taking out a relatively high interest rate loan for a household expenditure, which they could have saved up for, but instead they're borrowing and then paying down, this tells us that there's something about a savings vehicle that's not working for them. They either don't have access or the product they have access to is not helping them reach their goal. Why is that? Because if they could manage to save up rather than borrow down for a planned expense, then they would have a lot more money for consumption, for food in the household at the end of the day. And so it really shows us that we need to work harder on some of the other financial services that people should have access to, and we need to figure out what's going on with those that they aren't the high quality that they could be.
Dean Carlin, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, too. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Dean Carlin is co-author of a new paper on the impact of a microcredit program in the Philippines. You can read the paper, as well as a related perspective article, in this week's Science. From microcredit in the Philippines, we turn next to inner-city Chicago and the impact of another sort of intervention, high-quality preschool education. In a long-term study published online this week by Science, a team led by Arthur Reynolds of the University of Minnesota tracked graduates from one such noted program, the Child Parent Center in Chicago, beginning at graduation from the preschool program and up through age 28. The team then compared the outcomes on a variety of educational and socioeconomic indicators, ranging from occupational status and income to substance abuse and incarceration rates, with those of a control group that received a less intensive variety of early intervention. The result suggests that a little good preschool can go a very long way indeed, and has implications for designing the kind of early interventions that can make a real difference for at-risk children. Reynolds spoke with me from his offices in Minnesota.
What we tried to do in the study is to look at the very long-term effects of participation in a high-quality early childhood intervention program that's run through public school. What we're trying to do is to follow a group born in 1980 to follow their progress, their well-being, up to the age of 28. In the field, in general, the growth of longitudinal studies have really enhanced the understanding of how children learn and develop, and in the field of developmental science, it's very important to examine the influences and how do we continue the positive influences from early childhood development to young adulthood and beyond. And our challenge was that we were trying to follow the progress of 1,500 children that were residing in the Chicago public schools and some of the highest poverty areas in the city of Chicago, in the United States, you know, as a matter of fact, and to track progress and to interview them to better understand the influences on their lives. The goal of our study was really to look at the contribution of participation in the Child Parent Center early education program that is a preschool to third grade early childhood intervention program that's been implemented in Chicago since the 60s.
Okay, well, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about how the study was set up. It does sound to me like a very complex problem, as you suggest, kind of teasing out the variables and following this group over such a long period.
Yeah, and so what we selected was a group of all the graduates, all the children that participated in the Child Parent Center program in the Chicago Public Schools in the mid-1980s, 1,000 of them, and we sampled and got strong participation from the entire child population that was participating in the Child Parent Centers in the mid-1980s and kids that were going to be in kindergarten in 1986. And to compare them to what would be expected without the participation, we used the usual intervention services among sort of a matched group of kids that were taken from randomly selected schools that were participating in the usual intervention services that time for at-risk kids, at-risk because of poverty. So the comparison was between this highly innovative early childhood intervention program versus the progress of kids in the existing alternative early childhood intervention program.
And so you were comparing these two groups. What measures were you actually comparing the two on?
So we're looking at progress. Usually one would be their level of school readiness, their language development, math development skills as they entered kindergarten, the progress that they made in sort of word analysis skills and literacy and in numeracy during kindergarten, the level of parent involvement, how frequently parents participate in their children's education, teachers' ratings of the children's classroom performance. And as we went over time, of course, and we followed the progress every year, we looked at things like the performance on standardized tests of reading and math, whether the two groups had similar rates of need for remedial education services. And so those were the school outcomes. And as the kids got older, of course, we looked at other kinds of outcomes involving in the justice system, child abuse and neglect, other kinds of socio-emotional and family indicators of well-being.
So you were tracking this group all the way through. You weren't just looking at their outcomes as adults, but you were looking also at sort of their experience all the way through the system.
Yeah, and that's some of the advantage. You know, our study was a prospective longitudinal study rather than a retrospective study, because in a prospective study, you get assessments and understanding on a regular basis over kind of extended periods of time. And so we could look at not only the short-term impacts, but also the intermediate and long-term, and now into the very long-term effects up to age 28. And so if you detect these very long-term effects, you can try to understand how it accumulates, how it occurs, the process by which you're generating these effects over time.
Obviously, there's a huge number of things that you seem to be looking at here. Could you just tell me what you thought were some of the most striking findings of your study?
You know, the main things, the really important findings, one is in the area that in the past we found effects on educational attainment, at earlier ages, and now, at age 28, we're finding that those educational advantages lead to changes in socioeconomic status, such that kids in the Child Parent Center program have higher levels of job skills, they have higher socioeconomic status, they had higher annual earning compared to kids that got the usual early childhood intervention services in the study sample. On the other hand, we found that there were significantly lower rates of involvement in the justice system. Kids in the Child Parent Center program had lower rates of felony arrest. They had significantly lower rates of incarceration or jail during the years from 18 up to age 27 or 28. And further, kids in the preschool program had significantly lower rates of substance abuse. So the breadth of findings beyond just education into socioeconomic status, into health and social behavior were quite important. And also, we found as a function of the higher education that kids in the program, the graduates of the program by age 28, they also had higher rates of health insurance coverage, and including from employers. As a function of their improved educational status, they were more likely to get jobs that paid better and also had benefits.
So this preschool experience just really seemed to endure.
It did, and I think it's a very unique program, and it covers a wide swath of services. You know, there's over 500 hours of intervention that's being provided each year. And so in most of the cases, kids were getting multiple years of intervention and even intervention into kindergarten and the early school grades that we also found some benefits for. So I think there's a level of dosage and intensity of services that were really contributing to these long-term effects that we haven't really observed before. And that this is being done not by sort of a model new program, but by a program that's routinely implemented, in a large public school system. And this program is the second oldest federally funded preschool program in the country, after Head Start, after the Head Start program.
So how might this apply to other programs, or what sort of messages do you think other programs might take from this?
I think one is that certainly the investments have to start much earlier than they currently do, and that these investments beginning in preschool have to be significant enough and high enough in quality to make a significant impact on child development. And I think the challenge is to just make those kinds of quality, high quality of programs available. So what we find is that you can make investments in early childhood, but it's only the investments that are high in quality that follow those principles, comprehensive services, high intensity, focus on parent involvement, focus on literacy and language development, certified teachers, and sort of this continuity all within the same sort of setting that gives you these long-term and enduring effects.
You said this was a prospective study. Have you been involved with this study since the beginning, or...?
I have. I think in the beginning, 1985 is when our study started, about when the kids were 5 years old. And, of course, we got a lot of earlier information from birth records and other sources from them at that time. But, yeah, a couple of early childhood educators in the Chicago Public Schools got me involved as sort of an evaluator, and we sort of expanded it from then. So it's not your typical, longitudinal study that usually starts in higher education and universities or in research institutes. But we started it sort of within the public school setting and decided, well, the findings look strong. Let's follow them one more year. Let's follow them in the first grade, in the second grade, in the third grade. And lo and behold, the findings were strong enough and that we really thought, the program was on to something here.
So will the study continue?
Yeah, our plan is that we want to follow the sample, and in fact, to age 30 to 35, and to understand the continuing effects into midlife, sort of on the verge of midlife, in terms of effects on other dimensions, whether the effects carry over to the next generation in terms of parenting and school achievement of the kids of the sample members that we followed. And will allow us to look at other larger effects on things like, the development of health disparities, or whether there's an influence of intervention, on chronic health and disease, cardiovascular risk, things like that. We sense so far is that those effects are carrying forward. But certainly most of the effects that we see in adulthood by age 30 or so, you know, are being sort of initiated by these early experiences in the family, early school experiences as kid makes transitions to school, and that those effects carry over. There's a chain reaction that occurs.
Arthur Reynolds, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Arthur Reynolds is lead author of a paper that tracked the impact of quality preschool education well into adult life. You can read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. In a News Focus article this week in Science, contributing correspondent Michael Balter writes about a unique location in South Africa that's providing new insights on the ways complex cognition developed in humans over the past 100,000 years. He spoke with me about it by phone from Santa Cruz, California. Here's Michael Balter.
Back in March, Science sent me down to South Africa to visit what is probably, at the moment, the most important so-called Middle Stone Age site in all of Southern Africa, a site called Sobudu. It's about 40 kilometers north of Durban in the KwaZulu-Natal province and is a rock shelter above the Tongati River. Now, the Middle Stone Age is a very, very critical period in human evolution. It's kind of arbitrarily defined as between about 300,000 and 40,000 years ago. But during the latter part of the Middle Stone Age is when a lot of the cultural developments that we associate with modern humanity, symbolism, art, complex cognition, complex tool making, and hunting strategies began to really appear in the archaeological record. Sobudu, because it has an unbroken record of occupation stretching from about 38,000 years ago, all the way back to at least 77,000 years ago and probably several tens of thousands of years earlier once it's fully excavated, is kind of a living laboratory or living archaeological laboratory for uncovering what modern humans were doing during these very critical periods of time.
Well, with such a long period of human habitation, this must be a pretty special place. Are there any ideas why humans kept coming back here?
Well, obviously, you can't know for sure, and you have to speculate. Lynn Wadley, who's an archaeologist at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, who has led the excavations at Sobudu for the last 12 years, points out that it was a very beautiful, sheltered place. It was a place where there were a lot of fruit trees, a lot of forest animals that could be caught, possibly caught in snares and traps, as well as larger animals that could be hunted in the region. So it was quite rich and lush, probably compared with some of the more savanna-like landscapes that might have been found just, you know, within the surrounding region. So it clearly was a favorite place. It's very beautiful to us today, and there's no reason to think that it wasn't considered to be very beautiful by the humans who lived there as long as 77,000, perhaps even 100,000 years ago.
You mentioned Lynn Wadley. She certainly seems to have been particularly associated with this site.
That's right. Lynn Wadley is, well, she's retired now, although retirement didn't stop her from continuing to dig at Sobudu through this year, where she's now going to be handing on the torch to another archaeologist. But for the last 12 years, Lynn Wadley has been leading the excavations there. She is very much associated with the site, and what's been accomplished there is obviously very closely associated with her reputation. But she's assembled quite a large team of specialists who have uncovered everything from how stone tools were made, the bedding made of grasses and sedges that people seem to have slept on when they stayed there. And I should point out that a second ago I said the people live there. That's probably not exactly the right way to look at it. These were hunter-gatherers who roamed nomadically through the countryside. But we do know that they had favored places where they would spend a certain amount of time, bed down, perhaps for a period of days, perhaps for weeks, during certain times of the year. And it does appear that they would return repeatedly to these favorite sites.
Well, you noted earlier that this cave has become, I think you said, a living laboratory for studying human culture and perhaps you could say the development of human cognition. Just how does one study something like the development of human cognition through archaeology?
Well, that's a very good question because there's a lot of debate about this. If you're trying to study something like the evolution of language, it's very difficult to make inferences from the archaeological record. You can assume that if people could engage in other kinds of symbolic activity, like making art or making personal ornaments such as beads out of snail shells, which is very common in southern Africa and is definitely something that was done at Sobutu, you can then make some inferences that this kind of symbolic activity would have required language or that it involved the same cognitive abilities that something like language does. And Lynn Wadley has kind of distinguished herself by preferring, instead of talking about modern human behavior and more abstract terms like that, she prefers a term which she calls complex cognition. So instead of looking at more nebulous ideas about symbolism, she has tried to look at what people were capable of technologically and made inferences and conclusions, some more speculative and some less so, and some based on circumstantial evidence about what they were capable of.
Could you give some examples of the kinds of arguments she's making?
Yes, let's take sort of two very important cases that have been discussed out of Sobutu based on the findings there and which have been published in the archaeological literature by Wadley and her colleagues. One is the making of tools. Now, it's one thing to sort of take a piece of stone and kind of bang on it with either a bone or with another stone and create a cutting tool, a hand axe, or a flake or a blade. It's another thing to create a composite tool, something that has multiple parts. Now, one type of tool that has multiple parts would include if you take a stone tool and haft it onto a wooden or bone handle, you've got to go through multiple steps to do that kind of thing. And Wadley and her colleagues have looked at traces of the kinds of materials that were used to make the stone stick to the handle, basically. And you've got things like beeswax, acacia gum from acacia trees, and also ochre. And ochre is often interpreted as being symbolic or the sign of symbolic activity when it's found at archaeological sites. But Wadley has argued that it also has very good adhesive properties and that ochre might have been used to help as part of this kind of multi-component recipe to stick tools onto handles. Be that as it may, the whole process of creating this tool made of multiple parts would have required a more complex kind of cognition than perhaps earlier hominids used several hundred thousand years ago or a couple of million years ago. Another example, which is a little bit more based on circumstantial evidence, is the conclusion that they have come to that the people at Sobutu probably used snares and traps to capture some of their prey, especially some of the smaller animals. In the faunal or animal bone record at Sobutu, you find quite a high proportion of a little antelope called the blue duiker and a very aggressive little pig called the bush pig. Now, the rock shelter Sobutu is fairly high above the river. When I visited, I had to scramble up a fairly steep slope with loose rocks to get up there, and I was very glad when I finally made it to the top. So you find these animals which have been brought back up to the rock shelter. And both this little antelope and this bush pig are very difficult to hunt, even with bows and arrows, which the evidence suggests did exist at Sobutu. And I should mention are probably the earliest bows and arrows we know about 64,000 years ago. But hunting these little animals with bows and arrows was really very, very difficult. So circumstantially, Wadley and her colleagues have concluded that they must have used snares and traps to catch them. And this also correlates with current knowledge, or very recent historical knowledge, from tribes in Africa and the Kalahari and so forth that eat these kind of animals, and they tend to catch them with snares and traps as well. So you have kind of a parallel between what modern hunter-gatherers are doing and what prehistoric hunter-gatherers might have done.
In the story, you say that only 3 of the 8 meters of sediment that represent human habitation here have been excavated so far. Sounds like work at this cave is going to go on for a while.
Yes, absolutely. This was Lynn Wadley's last season, and I was lucky enough to be there and catch her during this very last excavation season that she's going to be involved in. Now she's really retiring, at least from excavation. I'm sure she'll continue to publish. The guy who's taking over for her is an archaeologist at the University of Tübingen in Germany named Nicholas Konard. Konard is very well known for his studies of the Upper Paleolithic period in Europe, of the period called the Natufian just before farming in the Near East, And he's also worked in South Africa, although further over in the west, around the Cape of South Africa. So widely considered him to be kind of the perfect successor, and Nicholas did agree to do this. So his team was already there, kind of getting habituated to the dig when I was there this year, and beginning next year, they will take over in full force.
Michael Balter, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Michael Balter writes about Sibudu Cave and the work of Lynn Wadley and her colleagues there in a News Focus in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here to fill us in on a few of the stories that appeared recently on our daily news site. Well, David, geese, bats, and spiders, a real creature feature today. Shall we start with the mammals?
Yes, we shall. Let's start with the bats. And what's interesting about bats, and also kind of bad about bats, is that they spread rabies, mostly among each other. But in the U.S., they also infect 1 to 2 people every year. Now, that may not sound like a lot of people, but rabies is almost always fatal, so this is a very serious disease. And for a long time, scientists have wondered how bats transmit rabies so well and why the virus doesn't kill the bats. It eventually does, but why it doesn't kill all the bats off before they can spread.
So they can be carriers for a while before they die.
Exactly. And the mechanism's been kind of unclear up until now. In this new study, researchers followed bats in Colorado during a 5-year field study. So they really looked at these guys for a long time. They watched their behavior. And what they found is that hibernation seems to really be key to spreading rabies. And the reason is because, as I said before, rabies would normally kill bats very quickly. But if the bats are infected before they hibernate, when they actually hibernate, the virus kind of hibernates as well. So these bats can harbor the virus for a long time. And then when they emerge from hibernation, a couple things happen. First of all, they're emerging from hibernation in the summer. They could be potentially attacking people during that time, although that, again, that's extremely rare. But they still have the virus in their blood, and they aren't dead yet to pass that virus along. Also, an important thing that happens in the spring, right after the hibernation ends, is that females leave their hibernation roosts for colonies where they go and give birth and raise their young. And these colonies are full of bats, and these bats are grooming each other, nipping each other. These are really ideal conditions for the bats to be transmitting rabies among each other, which really keeps the virus going.
Was this an observational study, or was it modeling? How did they do this?
It was observation. It was also modeling. And the interesting thing the researchers found with the modeling is if they took hibernation out of the picture, so they worked with the model to say, okay, what if the bats didn't hibernate? Both the bats and the virus went extinct. So hibernation is very important for the bats, but it's also very important for the virus.
Okay, and next, an epic migration for some geese. These sound like rather remarkable animals, actually.
Yes, definitely. These geese, at least according to one of the authors of this new study, have the most extreme migration on Earth. And the reason she says that is because way up in the Himalayas, and this is a mountain range that has some very, very tall mountains, including Mount Everest, hikers up there will sometimes observe bar-headed geese honking their way as they ascend powerfully overhead. Now, these are incredible.
So the hikers are sitting gasping for breath,
exactly.
And the geese are just
sort of flying overhead.
So
not only is this a very high ascent that the geese have to make as they are migrating from their summer breeding grounds in Central Asia, but the geese also seem to be making this ascent very quickly. In fact, in the study, the researchers found that the geese are ascending 6,000 meters in just 7 or 8 hours, which is basically a vertical ascent of 1.4 kilometers per hour, which would kill a person to ascend that quickly. And this is an ascent these animals are making every year. And up until now, people have thought, well, the geese must be getting some sort of help with this. There are some pretty strong tailwinds that occur in this mountain range, and perhaps the geese are waiting and harnessing these tailwinds to help sort of push them up over the mountains. But that's not what the researchers found here. In fact, they found even more impressive than this migration and this ascent that the geese are performing is that they're actually doing it under their own power. And this was, again, an observational study. The researchers here actually captured geese and they tagged them with satellite trackers so they could track when they were migrating and how long the migration took and what heights they were reaching and things like that. And in addition to the figures I cited just a couple minutes ago in terms of how high and how fast they're ascending, the researchers found that, surprisingly, the geese were making their journeys typically at night or in the early morning.
And why does that make a difference?
That makes a difference because actually the tailwinds are not very strong during this time of day. They're actually much stronger during the daytime. And so the geese are not flying during a period where they would be able to harness tailwinds, which strongly suggests that they're getting over these mountains using their own power. They're not really relying on Mother Nature to help them along. And the reason the researchers think the geese are traveling at this time of day is because the temperatures tend to be cooler at night and in the early morning, which would help dissipate body heat. There's also more oxygen available during this time of day. So they are still getting a bit of an assistance from Mother Nature because they're flying at more ideal times of day. But really, this is an incredible migration because the geese are using their own physiology and their own muscle strength and their own oxygen reserves to get over these mountains. They're not relying on an assist from the wind.
And finally, turning to the arachnids, it sounds like we have some scuba diving spiders on hand here.
Yeah, this is actually my favorite story of the lot. This story concerns a tiny brown spider known as Argyroneta aquatica, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. This is a spider that lives in ponds in northern Europe. And what makes this spider so extraordinary is it's the only spider in the world that spends its entire life underwater. And the way it does this is scientists already knew that these spiders weave these almost what they call diving bells, which are basically these sacks of air that they weave from their silk, and they fill them with oxygen and they bring them underwater with them. Really incredible. And there's some really cool pictures of this you can actually check out on the site. So that was all known. But until now, researchers thought that the spiders had to be constantly refilling these sacks, that they could only fill them with a limited amount of oxygen, would bring them down. And when the oxygen ran up, they had to keep on going back to the surface, refilling them with oxygen. Well, fortunately, a group of researchers, or in this case, a pair of researchers who were really fascinated by these spiders. They went out, they captured some of these spiders, brought some of them back to the lab. What they did was, thanks to advances in technology, they were able to utilize a tiny fiber optic oxygen sensor, which is called an optode. And this sensor is only about 15 microns in diameter. And what the researchers could do with these optodes is they were small enough that they could actually poke it through the webby membrane of this diving bell without messing up the diving bell.
And wow.
It's pretty cool. And this sensor was actually able to measure how oxygen and other gases move through the diving bell surface. And what they found, what was really amazing, is that these diving bells function kind of like fish gills underwater. So yes, the spiders fill them with oxygen on land and bring them with them underwater. But when the spiders suck oxygen out of this diving bell, the diving bell is actually able to suck oxygen from the water and replenish itself.
How on earth does that work? Do they know?
The researchers don't know exactly how it works. Again, they're thinking it works a little like a gill, and through the process of osmosis, basically when the oxygen is sucked out of the bell is trying to somehow replenish its oxygen supply and is trying to suck oxygen from the water. Is it actually able to do this? The upshot is that the spiders are actually, instead of constantly jumping out of the water and trying to refill their bell, which is what scientists thought earlier, the spiders are actually able to stay underwater for up to 24 hours. And the only reason they have to go back up is not really because the bell runs out of oxygen, but because the water pressure is so great that eventually over that time period, it tends to crush the bell and the spiders have to go make a new one. But what's really cool about this is that, A, it allows the spiders to be underwater for a long period of time. And that's really where they're doing their hunting. They're also spinning these webs underwater that catch water fleas and other organisms. And by having this constant supply of oxygen, they can bring their diving bell with them, take a suck of oxygen, hang out for a while underwater, weave their webs, do some hunting. When they run out of oxygen, return to the web. And so it really allows them to spend most of their lives underwater, which is pretty incredible.
Well, David, what other stories are you looking at for Science Now?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about nicotine and weight loss, understanding why smoking actually helps some people lose weight, even though it's got other problems, obviously. And also a story about a new way to prevent strokes using magnetic fields. For Science Insider, we've got a story about a patent fight over a commonly used HIV test and the impact that could have on academic research. Also, the latest on the E. coli outbreak that's currently roiling Europe and what scientists are contributing to trying to figure out what's causing the outbreak and how to resolve it. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about finding alien life within our own solar system. Scientists have, in recent years, really been looking beyond our sun to find alien life in these exoplanets that we've been finding light years from our sun. But there may be life on Mars, Europa, Enceladus, a lot of other worlds within our solar system. So we'll have a nice chat with two very prominent experts in the field about that topic. So be sure to check out all these items on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the June 10th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.